You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
So normally I'm based between New York City and Tel Aviv, so you know I divide my time between the two. As it so happened, from the start of the pandemic, I was actually already in Tel Aviv. So then everything that I had that I was going to have in New York got canceled, you know, as far as gigs and whatnot. So it didn't make sense for me to travel back there, especially since New York was one of the, and possibly the worst place to be in the world in that moment, as far as COVID goes. And so I've been here quarantined in Tel Aviv with my family. We've been living as a COVID unit or a COVID bubble. And that's been one of the silver linings of this period. I mean, it's been rough, but that's definitely been a silver lining. And so I've been here in Tel Aviv most of the time, with the exception of about a month in which I did need to go back for the one gig I had this past year that wasn't canceled. And that was actually a film production that was done, a filmed opera production with all of the COVID safety precautions in place. And it was with a company called Teatro Grattacielo. So they do what are called a verismo opera. So that's like late 19th century, early 20th century Italian opera, operas that are not as well known. So one of the things that's really appealing to opera audiences is that through that company, they get to hear rarities that they wouldn't normally get to hear in a normal opera going experience. So these are precisely the kinds of operas that Teatro Grattacielo put on. So this one gig that I had that did not get canceled and that they were able to do safely, I mean, with the safety precautions, was a production of this, again, rarely done opera called Giordano's Fedora. I mean, Giordano was the composer. And it was really beautiful. And having one gig, one, was a godsend in this past year. So I'm really grateful to them for that.
That one special one. I know, in talking to a lot of guests, remembering that show, whether they were participants in the show or outside of it. We're talking with Kinneret Ely, soprano, opera singer. It's a great pleasure to have you on the show. And again, from Tel Aviv, and your work based in Tel Aviv and in New York City. It's a great privilege to have you on here, Kinneret, and thanks for joining Something Rather Than Nothing.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be on.
I want to know you're an artist, you're a trained artist, you work hard every day at doing it. Were you an artist when you were born?
Well, I think the interesting thing there is that I think every person has a creative bent when they're born. You know, there was actually a Pablo Picasso quote that came to mind when thinking about this, which was, and I'll have to paraphrase. I'm not kind of putting words in Picasso's
That's
mouth,
what we do here, paraphrase.
But that everybody, I will paraphrase away. So anyway, there's something that Pablo Picasso once said, and I apologize for the Tel Aviv traffic in the background. In any case, he said something to the effect of, all children are born artists. The question is making sure to remain an artist when you get older. So I really think that everybody has some kind of creative bent and a need to express themselves creatively. Now, whether, you know, people decide to take that and build a career around that or not, or, you know, whether that's something they want to do is a whole other question, or whether it's something they're passionate about. But I think that everybody has a creative side to them. And that's also why the arts are so relevant to society, because even if somebody isn't necessarily a painter, or they don't necessarily relate to opera specifically, or theater specifically, ballet specifically, or what have you, people do have a need to create in some sort of capacity and to experience creativity from others. So I really think that Picasso was onto something when he said that.
Yeah, I've had many interviews on the show, and I got to say, this is one of like the formative questions, and it fascinates me because I do really agree and move along towards the line of whatever art abilities or art ideas or ways of expression. I think there's a universal aspect to it, and I think that there's something there's something about like an adult unlearning too for folks who have been out of it. I started art, you know, formally in my life, I'm 48 at 45, right? So like, I like to imagine and thinking back that there were things there, and it's just the environment that you move through, whether that's accentuated. You gave the conceptual answer there, which is obviously what I want, but were you singing when you were a little baby? I mean, were you singing when you were a little baby? Were you always singing?
I have such a funny story to tell about that. Okay, so first of all, one of the things that a lot of us opera singers, we opera singers do frequently is we'll do what are called opera outreach performances. So we'll go to places like schools, you know, and hospitals and whatnot and sing, you know, with the purpose of bringing our art to people who wouldn't be able to experience opera in a theater in the quote unquote conventional format. So in any case, the reason I say all of this is because I actually did an outreach performance at my old elementary school about a couple of years ago. So I see my old second grade teacher there. She was still teaching there. And she says to me, "I remember you back when you were 7 years old. You were a fireball who would lead your classmates in singing songs all together." And the funny thing is, I have no recollection of that. But I will say that given that I ended up growing up to become a professional opera singer, clearly nothing has changed since I was 7 years old, based on her description of me then. So from that, I think that, yeah, I did have an artistic bent back then, even if I didn't have no recollection of that.
It was such a natural, well, it's one of those things. Sometimes there's something like a natural outcropping of behavior. You don't remember it because it's so natural and flowing. So I want to just pose the next question just with a tiny bit of background. You know, it has to do about like the impact of art. And if, and I want to be just specific about, you know, getting you as an opera soprano singer on here, and as a point of fascination for me and also for the variety of the show. You know, I'm trying to learn about opera. I'm trying to study and listen to it. And there's so many components to it. It's a little bit intimidating.
Oh, yes.
multiple languages. The regular 21st century viewer says, who's bad, who's good, and is trying to figure all that out. But one of the things that seems to be a very lofty, very incredible art form, and that brings my question about art. One of the things that really impacts me as a viewer of art is when things seem to be sublime, seem to be bigger than us. Is the presence of sublimity, say in opera or that experience, are there certain forms of art that are sublime?
I really think that every art form has the potential to be sublime, or, you know, there's the potential to create a sublime work within that art form, whether in opera or in ballet or, you know, visual art like painting. And at least for me, first of all, art is very subjective, of course. For me, something that's really sublime is when you're able to have a really honest and direct expression of something, of some kind of emotion, especially. And also when it's able, it's honest, and yet it's also made beautiful somehow. Because a lot of these great works of art deal oftentimes with topics that are ugly or that are difficult to talk about, especially opera, in which at least 90% of the time they have tragic endings. So they're able to take topics that are really difficult and make them really beautiful. And, you know, they're able to take a really honest and vulnerable and direct topics and also really condense them into, what, 3-hour operas? A lot of these operas are about topics that we spend our entire lives thinking about. Love, anger, hatred, jealousy. I will also say, lightheartedness in the case of comedies and opera, you know, but a lot of these things that we spend our entire lives thinking about, and they're being condensed into 3 hours, or let's say even 5 hours, which for an opera would be considered on the longer side. But as far as a topic that we spend a lot of time thinking about all throughout our lives, that's a very short time, actually. And then it's given this really beautiful expression through the power and the vulnerability of the human voice, and also by the orchestra. And, you know, then a whole bunch of these powerful, vulnerable voices coming together as a chorus. So that is really the sort of thing that can make an art form sublime, an opera sublime specifically. So honesty and directness combined with beauty for me is what the recipe is for something that's really incredible.
Thank you for that description. I really appreciate your indulgence on that answer, because part of it is exploratory for me, because I experienced the sublime as a viewer of art mostly with painting. So, which of course is a particular experience, right? Of like, how does a painting, how does a regular size painting that doesn't overwhelm you with like the sheer scope of it, you know, the experience of the sublime, which is a very unique experience compared to the more visceral, emotive work that you do. I find it fascinating that both can produce the sublime, even though their methods couldn't be more different.
Yeah. Oh, the methods couldn't be more different. Absolutely couldn't be more different. And I do remember some of my own, visual art viewing experiences that did really hit me so powerfully when I saw them. And one that comes to mind immediately as we're speaking now is when I first saw, and I have to admit, I'm not totally solid about the pronunciation of the painting, which is embarrassing because it's a famous one, but Pablo Picasso's Guernica, I believe that's the pronunciation of it.
Guernica.
Oh, Guernica, excuse me.
In the scope of it, the Spanish Civil War, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh my gosh. I mean, it was just devastating. I mean, in the best way, seeing this painting by him was absolutely devastating, because you really get a sense of how contorted and twisted all of the figures are in the painting. Yeah. And through that, you really get a feeling of the devastation of the Spanish Civil War. And I mean, my God, the ability for a canvas to be able to do that is, and to do it in really a second, because how long does it take to look at a painting and get
the
that
whole experience?
You can study it for a while, and that you'd be studying it over time, but that immediate impact of seeing it would be in that second. And actually, to that point, there was actually a really wonderful piece of advice as far as, you know, how this applies to opera. That one of my coaches, Jorge Parodi, gave. So I'm giving Jorge a shout out. Hi. So he said once, when he was asked what advice would you give to somebody attending the opera for the first time? Do we have to prepare anything? Do any reading and whatnot? And he said, no, don't do any preparation before you go to the opera, because you have one time in your life in which you can watch it without knowing what's going to happen next. And, you know, being at the edge of your seat, following the story, there's only one time in your life in which you'll get to have that experience, and then you'll never get to have it again. You can watch an opera over and over and get to enjoy multiple layers in the story and in the composition of the music, but that kind of immediate first impression of it is something that you'll only get to experience once. So to really take advantage of that.
Not the advice I expected, right? I hear that advice, though. It's kind of being thrown into the world and make your way around for once, right? Within it.
Yeah, exactly. And also not to go into, and I fully agree with this. And there are a lot of the, I'll just let that cargo. So in any way, there are a lot of the operas that I would love to have that kind of first experience watching it again. And as much as I love being able to see them for, you know, let's say the 30th time or the 40th time or what have you, and getting to enjoy even more layers in it, I do also really wish I could have that experience again of watching it for the very first time and experiencing it as a brand new thing. So I would really embrace that. And there's another thing I really love about that advice that Jorge gave, which is that it really kind of throws out the idea that you have to have done, you know, read a dissertation before you even set foot into an opera house. I totally don't think that's true. There are certainly very academic components to what makes up an opera, but at the end of the day, it's a very visceral art form. and its powers in the primal expression of that human voice, unamplified human voice, kind of hitting you inside a theater, you know, experiencing that human voice inside a theater.
Yeah, just fundamental, powerful. Thank you for your thoughts on that. And don't worry about the traffic in Tel Aviv. My cat,
okay,
who you see is seen in the background. For listeners, we're recording this interview, but we have able to see each other from Tel Aviv and from Oregon. My cat has bit me twice since this interview began. I think the Tel Aviv horns, it's very friendly, she loves me. I think the Tel Aviv horns are much less of a problem than her behavior at present, and she's yelling out to you singing, so
I love it. We'll sing a duet, the cat duet by Rossini.
So, Kinneret, I have another question, that was based on, so in order to prep for this interview and my general interest in opera, I listened to some lectures and kind of here's a piece and learn about this history, just kind of heavy, you know, intro, piece. And then the instructor on that, Robert Greenberg, done a lot of lectures on great courses as a composes stuff on his own, really smart guy. I wanted to get your reaction to this quote because I was trying to understand fundamentally maybe what opera is, you know, for the experience and its relation to emotions. He said, opera is posited on the simple idea that music has the power to distill, crystallize, and intensify the meaning of words. And I'm just going to read that again for the listeners. Opera is posited on the simple idea that music has the power to distill, crystallize, and intensify the meaning of words. Is he right?
That's another thing that's very subjective. And I would both agree and disagree with that quote. I agree in the sense that things like chord progressions or whatever musical markings are written with a certain word can certainly give it a lot more dramatic of a power. And as a matter of fact, earlier this week, I had a rehearsal for this opera I'm getting ready for this July, Mozart's Idomeneo. More on that in just a moment. But in any case, the rehearsal was really all about those details and really emphasizing things like taking advantage of a certain chord progression that there is under a word to really give it a lot more dramatic weight. So in that sense, I fully agree with you know, Greenberg's quote. I disagree in the sense that, again, for me, the fundamental power of opera is in experiencing the unamplified human voice in a theater. And for me, that's the reason that somebody can attend a performance of, let's say, you know, Verdi's La Traviata or Puccini's La Bohème, just as a couple examples of some of the, I guess, cornerstone operas. And so somebody can go into the theater and listen to those works and be absolutely blown away by them without even knowing a single word of Italian and experiencing that impact of the human voice is why. And then, of course, the opera going experience becomes even richer in the sense of kind of like experiencing layers in an onion. You know, in that sense, it becomes even richer the more you know about it. But that impact is not something that necessarily hangs on whether you understand every single word or not.
Yeah. And what I was interested in most, and thank you for your thoughts on that too, because I'm going to continue thinking about it. I was interested primarily, again, like studied opera a bit on my own, experienced some, watched some newer to it, of emotion. Like for me, like going into it, I was like really, I'm really intellectually connected to the feeling in the story that's conveyed and connecting to voice. You say the unamplified
voice
telling that story.
Yes. Yes. 1000%. Yes.
Okay. So here's the thing. Whenever I have a guest who performs, I want the listeners to hear like your performance. And I have a recording that, you know, I was going to play and we can come back to and talk about it. But I was wondering if you can do a little bit of a setup. It's a song to the moon.
Yes.
Could you give a little bit of, just to help us place us here before we enter that song?
Absolutely. So this is an opera aria from an opera called Rusalka, which is by Dvorak. So this opera is in Czech. And it's basically the way I would describe it is as the Czech version of the Little Mermaid story, except this being an opera, it doesn't end well. Spoiler alert, sorry. But anyway, this is the aria that Rusalka, the title character, sings in Act 1. This is when she's singing to the moon, as the title of the aria suggests. And she's asking the moon to tell the prince. And this character is simply named the prince. This is very archetypal. And she's asking the moon to tell the prince that she loves him. And this aria is in Czech.
Wonderful. And my Czech is limited, but I do recall Dobrý den is hello to our Czech listeners. Dobrý den.
Dobrý den, jak se máš? I know a little bit of Czech. I've been taking lessons during the quarantine.
I did notice that. Okay, everybody. Song to the Moon by Kinnereth Ely. Here we go.
Thank you.
So people clap in that video. I don't know what to say or do after I hear that.
Thank you so much. Oh, the good vibes are all that I need. Thanks. Yeah, so that was taken at a live concert, and hence the applause at the beginning and the end. So so that was actually done in February 2020. So the timing of that couldn't have been better. This was a concert, a series of three concerts that I did actually here in Israel with two of my friends. One of them is tenor Pavel Sulianziga, and the other is a baritone, Suchan Kim. So Pavel is from Russia, and Suchan is from South Korea. And so we did three concerts here in Israel. So this was recorded in one of those concerts. And to have been able to do those concerts right before COVID hit is really just a miracle of timing that, you know, we couldn't even have known ahead of time when we originally started planning the concerts. So it's really amazing how that turned out. So, I'm really glad that we have those clips as evidence that we did actually do something in 2020. Because theaters all over the world had to close down. Yeah. Anyway.
I'm happy for you that you're able to have that, right? And of course, in retrospect to it, and talking about the art of the opera and your experiences, and I mentioned to you, you know, a lot of it feels new to me, and I have a deep amount of curiosity about, you know, certain aspects of it, so. I wanted to know if you could talk a bit about your career, your training. You know, what does for many of us, how does a soprano train? Where do you go? And then, but also, and related to the pandemic, which is just for live performers and the impact of that. I mean, one of the things I'm going to let you talk, but one of the things you had mentioned about even doing your auditions. I'm thinking high level auditions for an opera singer, for soprano, and you're doing it remotely. I just the idea is fascinating. So tell us about you as an opera singer. What's going on? How you arrived where you are?
Yeah. So first of all, how much time do you have? No, but seriously. So growing up, actually both in America and also in Israel. So first of all, just for clarity's sake, I spent the vast majority of my childhood in the United States, in Williamsburg, Virginia. So the land of powdered wigs and buckled shoes.
Yes.
But I also lived in Jerusalem here. So in both places, I actually ended up doing musicals in schools. You know, so in both countries, I was the musical theater kid. And then I started taking voice lessons because apparently I would just keep singing around the house. And I didn't think anything of it. I didn't have any kind of, you know, ambitions or anything at the time about it. So at the time I was 13 years old. My mother said, well, you know, she sings around the house. Why not put her in voice lessons? And this wasn't with any sort of thought of saying, oh, she'll have a career in musical theater. Or she'll have a career in opera. It was just more like an outlet of some kind of doing something that I was doing all over the house anyway, you know, like an after school activity. Yeah. And so I had my first voice lesson when I was 13. And I remember singing my favorite things at that first voice lesson and kind of cowering behind a music stand because I was very shy. And so that was how that began. And then the more I took voice lessons and the more my voice developed, the more I started developing high notes and my voice started evolving in a more operatic direction. And then at the time, this was when I was 15, 16, my voice teacher then asked me, have you ever thought about becoming an opera singer? And a little confession is that after he asked me that, I kind of went home and cried, because at that time, the opera performances I had seen up until that point, which was not that many, but they weren't especially well done. So in my conception, that was like what opera was. So the idea of kind of being asked, would you like to be an opera singer, was not the most appealing prospect at that time. But then what completely changed things. Yeah, what completely changed things is that then when I was 16, there's a opera program that was taking place here in Israel. And actually, so practically in my own, one of my backyards, I should say, you know, the U.S. is my backyard and Israel is my backyard. So practically in my backyard, a program called the International Vocal Arts Institute, or IVAI for short. And it was run by Joan Dorneman, who was one of the coaches at the Metropolitan Opera. So an incredibly high-level program. And the faculty that she brought there were some of the greatest singers and teachers in the world. And also the students that were chosen for it were phenomenal. And I remember the first event that I went to there, I went with my mother. And it was a masterclass with Cheryl Milnes, you know, the great baritone who'd sung with, you know, all the greatest singers and who'd had an incredible opera career, you know, was one of the best Rigolettos, you know, in Verdi's opera Rigoletto, and, you know, sang Louisa Miller, another Verdi opera. I mean, the list of his illustrious list just goes on and on and on. So the first event we attended was a masterclass with him. So you can imagine how seeing a masterclass given by him with incredible singers there would really kind of light a fire as far as opera would go. And then the more I attended things like masterclasses and concerts and opera productions there, the more I really fell in love with it. And then the rest is history. And then the following year, when I was 17, something quite freakish happened, in which my parents tried to contact Joan Dorneman saying, and this was really on a lark. This was with no expectation of anything happening. They just said, hi, we absolutely loved, you know, the opera workshop. And in any case, I have a daughter who's very interested in pursuing opera. Do you happen to have any advice for, you know, a high schooler who's interested in opera? And, you know, months and months and months passed and there was no reply. And again, there was no expectation of a reply even. Then we hear back, then there's a phone call, and on the caller ID, you see International Vocal Arts Institute. And we all look at each other like, and and then she says, we say, well, we're actually going to be going up to New York in a short time anyway. And she says, would you like to meet me there? We went, yeah. And, you know, and then I sang for her. And granted, I was a 17-year-old singer. I was really, really, really young. But she took me into the program for the following year, which was incredible. I know. I still can't believe it. So the thing about that program is it's a multi-tier program. So you had someone like me who was a high schooler, super, super young, totally green. And then you had people who were, you know, in their 30s already having opera careers and, you know, people in doing their bachelor's degree, master's degree. So you had all different levels. And so there was really something for every level to learn there. And then the beauty was being able to learn from the older singers as well as from the faculty. And so that experience was absolutely incredible. And I would say a pretty good start in the world of opera. So, decent.
That's incredible.
Oh, gosh, I didn't even get to talking about the pandemic.
There was more to it. But one of the things, we'll go to the pandemic next, outside view, opera, young singer, talented, pressure. What's it like? What's it like? What's it like being that person on the stage, the weight's on you, the performance, all that? Like, what's that like?
You know, I have to tell you that one of the things I really had to learn, because I do have sort of a perfectionistic bent in my personality as well. So first of all, you're totally right that something like that can be compounded in a field like opera, in which there's so many things you have to get just right. the way the voice is placed, with the musicality, with the languages, which you have to sound like a native speaker of, you know, Italian and French and German. And we opera singers frequently, you know, speak these languages as well. So you have to get that right. You have to get the acting right. And you have to put all of that together. And it really is kind of being asked to pat your head and rub your belly at the same time, or like walk and chew gum, or kind of a more extreme version of that. So some of the things that I've actually done for myself is really look for examples within other sort of perfectionistic worlds of people who are really able to find healthy ways to do that. And one of the articles that I read that really kind of struck my soul in this respect was something that I read in a magazine called Point Magazine. So this is actually a ballet magazine. And this was an article with Abby Stafford, who is the who is a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. And she talked about her first experience dancing, I believe it was 48 nutcrackers, but over 40 nutcrackers in the holiday season, because that's one of the most, if not the most intense period for New York City Ballet as far as performances. Yeah. So she talked about, her experience doing that. And she said that she came to the conclusion after that first season that as soon as, and here's the thing that really hit my soul. She said, as soon as I was able to stop, as soon as I stopped trying to dance perfectly, I was able to start dancing well. I was like, whoa. So really, and also too, when in my practice sessions, I'm always stressing to myself that my goal is progress, because perfection is impossible. You can never be perfect. You can aim for higher levels in your singing, in your musicality, in your languages, but you're never going to be perfect. Even the greatest singers in the world are not perfect. They're amazing, but they're not perfect. And one of the things I actually started doing was listening to live performances of, you know, Maria Callas and Joan Sutherland, not studio recordings in which you can, you know, fix a little thing. And in live performances, you know, they're like little mistakes and whatnot. And you go, oh, wait, it is actually okay to be human. You know, it's like there's a little more breathing room. So, and frankly, you need that breathing room because, again, perfection is impossible. And I think the second that you try and strive for that is the second you shoot yourself in the foot. So progress, progress, progress. And that's something that I stress both to myself and I would stress to anybody else as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate your comments there. And it just kind of, you know, again, like looking at it and seeing, you know, there's different art forms and there's different roles with whatever you're producing and there's different ways to hide, remove yourself, never be present, you know, when it comes to the art. And you're the opposite. Your role is the opposite of that.
We're very out in the open.
You are pretty much out in the open. Okay, so pandemic stuff, what I had mentioned. All right, so you're over there. You're in Tel Aviv. It's pandemic. You're a soprano. You're looking to work on different projects and auditions. Like, what? How do you pop on the... How do you pop on the computer and audition for the part?
Oh, yeah. So this is, first of all, so this has been a very fascinating learning curve all throughout the pandemic, you know, both for me and I know for the opera world at large. So first of all, just to set the stage a little bit, opera is such an inherently interactive art form. I mean, you have probably the biggest gathering of people on stage of any art form in that you have soloists and a chorus and oftentimes what are called supernumeraries. Oh God, I can't talk right now, or supers. So, you know, people who kind of fill in the stage, let's say holding a spear or whatnot, you know, aren't necessarily singing, but their presence is very important. You have dancers. So you have all of these people who need to be together and you have the orchestra, you know, in the orchestra pit, all of these people who need to be together in order for the art form to work. And, you know, then it's also backstage crew and then, of course, the audience. And then, of course, with COVID, none of those things were possible. And so seasons opera seasons all over the world had to be canceled for that reason, for health precautions. So then, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So we had to move a lot of what we could do in all of this span of everything we couldn't do. We had to focus on what we could do and really maximize the internet for that, or socially distanced environments. I know several opera companies are doing drive-through performances, which has been fantastic. I know English National Opera just did that with their production of La Boheme. And but we've also been doing things like live streaming concerts and live streaming masterclasses. So again, this would all be done over Zoom, and we would all be singing our part at home. And you see there's a piano in the background. So you'd be someone would be playing the piano in the background. I'd be singing next to my bookshelf or what have you, for potentially one of the greatest singers or teachers, you know, in the world for a masterclass. It's been really something. So we've all been adjusting to these new formats of doing operas. And many people have been doing what opera films. So people using green screen at home, and also Adobe Premiere Pro, and being able to create really incredible productions using this technology, and people recording their performances on their iPhones and then uploading that. And then the products of that those recordings are able to become a really beautiful artistic product, again, with equipment you have at home. And in a way, if this pandemic had to happen, I mean, that's a really awful sentence. I don't think it had to, but in a more philosophical sense, if it had to happen, it's good that it happened now rather than 20, 30 years ago, because we have so much technology at our disposal that we're really able to harness to create such incredible beauty in the sense of art, and then to really improve people's lives all across the board collectively. So we really have been able to use all these different tools at our disposal. Goodness, I don't know what it is today. Disposal, and create things that are absolutely spectacular. And again, with equipment that we have at home. So there are many things that the pandemic limited as far as opera, but it also opened so many new doors that I know are going to continue even after the pandemic is over, as far as the possibilities of our art form. And so that is really exciting, and I'm really eager to see what develops.
And we're speaking with Kinneret Ely here, and some great discussion regarding technology and around the pandemic, you know, maybe the time of the pandemic to be able to communicate still, and your experiences of auditioning from afar. I'd even mentioned to you about a documentary that I'm working on. And what's interesting, yeah, with the piece I didn't mention to you, is that it's all on an iPhone. The entire documentary is to be shot, edited, uploaded, etc., on an iPhone. And this is the second one I've done of this nature. And having the tech to be able to pull off a 5-minute film, you know, on the phone is a nice time to be able to try art that's like that, right? have that capacity.
Oh yes. I mean, that's the technology. Oh, no. I mean, I was just going to say that's the technology that we have now. I mean, people are creating, I mean, as you said, you know, people are creating films on their iPhones. And I just took a class about a week and a half ago in which they were addressing just that very fact. I mean, that's where technology has gone. And as much as live performances are essential, and I know people the globe over are clamoring to be back in the same room again and to have an experience of catharsis and of experiencing the same art form all together in the same room. I mean, as much as the live aspect of it has really been shown to us throughout this whole pandemic, I will also say that it's the pandemic has also revealed all of the possibilities of the technology that we have, such as being able to shoot whole films on our iPhones. And I think that taking advantage of that technology will be essential even after the pandemic, even after we return to live performances.
Yeah, that process of the possibilities remain, or whatever the possibilities be. I have a question for you, and I gotta admit, I actually don't like the question, but I'm going to try to tell you what I was trying to get at. So in thinking about opera and thinking about, you know, questions for you, particular to your art, one of the questions I had posed or was thinking about was about whether opera is in a position to kind of tell modern stories. I don't even like my statement. I don't like the question because I think the quick answer is like any art form in opera. I mean, these are universals. This is love. This is killing. This is murder. This is death. This is treachery. These are all these heavy type of things. And I don't expect right now to say that, you know, opera, you know, post-pandemic, you know, it can't do all that. I think those stories are the stories that they are. But opera's tied historically to this. How do I get to see an opera? Where is an opera? How long it is? What are they saying? It's like an accessibility question. So it's 2021, pandemic, you're a soprano singer. What's the opera do for us right now and into the future?
Yes. So first of all, yes, 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 yes. There absolutely is room for opera to tell modern stories. And this is really plugging back into what I said earlier about the power and the vulnerability of the unamplified human voice being the superpower here. And as far as a modern opera, and I'll say a 21st century opera, a perfect example of that would be Jake Heggie's Dead Man Walking. So that's the opera that Jake Heggie composed based on the movie by Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn, and in close collaboration with Sister Helen Prejean. And so we're talking about the death penalty, which is a very real topic that is affecting us in day-to-day life. You know, we're not talking about, you know, courtesans in the 19th century, you know, Paris, which even though there are universal themes in that, it's understandable that a topic like that wouldn't necessarily be the most relevant thing to us now in 2021, experiencing the modern day pandemic. And I get that. And I say that as somebody who loves Verdi's La Traviata. That's one of my favorite operas. And that's the one I was referring to when talking about the courtesans. But in any case, about Dead Man Walking, that is about a topic that is affecting us on a day-to-day basis. When we go to the voting polls, maybe people know others who've been touched personally by it. And so you're experiencing this issue through the lens of expression through the human voice. And so that gives a different perspective to it. And it's one that's absolutely devastating in the best sense, in the way that art has the capacity to be, absolutely devastating. And so that really speaks to its place in the modern day world. And even though I'm using Dead Man Walking as a clear example of that, that's true of opera all across the board right now, contemporary opera. So seeing the different stories that emerge during this period and what is going to be set, how it's going to be set, what topics are going to be chosen, that's going to be a very interesting thing to see. We're still in the early part of the century, so it'll be very fascinating to see what emerges, and then which of those operas kind of stand the test of time and whatnot, because that's the other thing. There were actually a lot more operas composed in, let's say, the 19th century and the 20th century, and then also the 18th century. And a lot of those we don't necessarily know about because for whatever reason, likely historical reasons, they didn't necessarily last. And so the ones that are the most frequently performed ones are the ones we most know about. But there are probably many other stories, really beautiful stories that have sort of collected dust over the years for whatever reason, that need to be told. And there were actually initiatives on that front about degenerate artists, so composers of the 1930s and also I believe early 1940s as well, during the period of the Third Reich. And a lot of these composers composed a really incredible music, but those voices were put out for, you know, obvious reasons, and it's such a tragedy. So there are initiatives to bring those works back and to bring new life to those modern to what are essentially, you know, modern stories. And so the more that we can give new life to those, new life in the sense of performing them, the more that opera will continue to evolve and be the incredibly flexible art form that it is, because it is flexible. It's over 400 years old. It has outlasted two world wars, you know, the Great Depression. It's outlasting COVID. It's it outlasted so many disasters that I think that any time that I heard, and even before the pandemic, that, oh, opera is a dying art form. Oh, it's collecting dust and it's all mothballs. I say, wait, no, it's not. It's so relevant because, and it's so powerful, and it's outlasted so many world calamities in a way that they didn't last. I mean, those calamities didn't last. So that speaks to the staying power of the art form, and also to its ability to fit into the modern world.
Yeah, and I appreciate your comments there. And I didn't want it to be a hackneyed type of question, you know, since, oh, what's it say for us now? What I found is just my personal impression, is that, you know, you hear these kind of large statements around like video versus audio and movies versus TV and, you know, classical forms of art. And, you know, I think it's cute to always make like dire predictions about the death of, you know, movies, right? The death of the movie theater.
Yeah.
And all I see is kind of strange adaptations. And I'll give you an example, right? So like there's this TV show that was just put out. It's called Calls. It's on Apple TV and I watched it. And what I found so fascinating in the pandemic and what art will come out now, why it's so fascinating, this is basically using a TV medium to squish in audio content and audio storytelling. There's no people, there's no actors, there's a voice file, and you see movement of the voice file, you hear voices, and an interwoven story is being told. You're watching the thing on a TV, and it's a radio program. It's not really a TV program. So I guess my main point is you start to see this conflation of video, is it audio, or you see with opera or classical forms and how they're presented. I think the answer to this question all the time is they're going to be around. They've been around.
Oh, yes.
And it'll look different as we go ahead. So,
you know, absolutely. And that's exactly how opera has evolved. I mean, at the beginning, it was, you know, in the style of composers like Monteverdi, who composed, you know, operas such as L'Incoronazione di Poppea, The Coronation of Poppea. And, you know, and also Orfeo. So that was one of the many versions of the Orpheus story, you know, Orpheus and the Underworld, that were set to opera. One of them's by Monteverdi. So if, in any case, what I'm saying is that if the art form of opera did not evolve, we would still be performing music like that. And everything you'd be hearing in an opera house would be in the Baroque style. But of course, that's not the case. You know, we have evolved through, you know, Handel, you know, Mozart, and, you know, Beethoven, we have the bel canto operas, Rossini, Donizetti. And I mean, I'm not going to rehash all 400 years here, but in any case, it has definitely gone through an evolution, and it will continue to do so. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, I remember in one of my music history classes, people talking about, about how Debussy was going to be the death of the art form of opera. Clearly that didn't happen. So, and he ended up composing one of the greatest operas in the repertoire called Pelléas et Mélisande. So it's Pelléas and Mélisande. So, and then the art form evolved further from that point. So it's always going to evolve. And that's the beauty of a living, breathing art form. It's going to evolve, and it's going to evolve with the times. And so that is what's really exciting. And the thing that ties all of those periods, those time periods of opera together, and those styles is, and I know I keep coming back to this, but it's such a key point for me, the unamplified human voice. That's always going to be what ties all of those periods together, and what's going to keep an art, what's going to keep opera, opera, at least in my view. And I know that there will be people who will debate me even on that, and that's totally fine. But for me, that's really the key element as far as the evolution of this art form and kind of keeping it within the within the boundaries. I hate that word, but I'll use it anyway. Within the boundaries of opera.
Well, but what about so in appreciate your comments. Connect that to the big question about what is art. You're talking about a living form of art. So the question is, what is art?
Yes, and that's a really, really huge question. I love it. So I think that art is all of these parts in our lives that we can't clearly compartmentalize and that we can't simply express just in our day-to-day lives, in a conversation, or, you know, in a class. It has to be sung. It has to be painted. It has to be danced. It has to be composed into a symphony. It can't simply be spoken. And so... art is really kind of a distillation of those parts of our lives and it being put into something really beautiful. I mean, for me, that beauty component is really important because that's going to be the thing that makes it possible for people to talk about difficult topics. You know, art really distills difficult topics into something that's manageable, something that you could attend an opera or a ballet or what have you for 3 hours and have a full emotional experience going to it. It's that kind of really powerful distillation and economy of a certain topic. And then art is the expression of that. And about how art can really sort of beautify a really horrific topic. One of my favorite operas is The Dialogues of the Carmelites by Francis Poulenc. And it's an absolutely phenomenal and also devastating opera that is about an order of Carmelite nuns who were guillotined during the French Revolution. I mean, they were martyred. So this is their story. And as you can imagine, it really is a horrific story, but the beauty that Poulenc is able to give to it in depicting this sisterhood of nuns who pulls together during such a horrific time is really what makes this topic bearable, I think. So, and even though that's one of the most powerful examples of this concept that I can think of, I think this is a concept all across the board. I mean, if you're talking about the topic of death in opera, you know, a certain character dying by the end of it, beauty is what helps make this, is what helps make it possible to express these things and what helps make it bearable. Because I think otherwise people, you know, we would be going our day-to-day lives without talking about those topics. And instead, something like an opera or a symphony or a play is saying, here's the topic. We're giving it in a way that's more palatable, if you will. That's beautiful. Now let's talk about it. It's a safe space of sorts that opens the floor to talking about what would otherwise.
Do you create art to create beauty? I mean, is that what compels you? Is that you go down, like you don't have to perform on stage, but you are. And when you are you trying to create that beauty, that sublime, that piece of art that makes it feel different?
I would say yes, absolutely. And even more than the beauty, and I would say in addition to that, the vulnerability, you know, the honesty, the empathy. And I think that is some, I don't know a single person who says, I have too much empathy in my life, enough. You know, we all want more empathy, and being able to create a space in which that's able to happen is something that's really critical and a superpower of the arts. One of the most special moments in any given time that I'm performing is that moment in which I feel a communion or a communication of some sort with the audience, in which we know we are experiencing something with each other, and not necessarily in the form of applause. This often happens in silences, you know, let's say in the silences in the music, when you can feel that, like, you know, like that pin drop moment. And you know that you're sort of in communication with the audience at that moment. And that is the form of vulnerability that I'm talking about, that is so palpable in a performance and that is so meaningful.
That's a profound thought. And I think it's interesting because I didn't expect you to say that, right? I mean, because we always want to have it. The vulnerability is the quality that is the human quality, but it's not the one to be like, hey, we go into a situation, like I'm work as a union rep, and like I go into a situation and say, hey, I feel really vulnerable. They're like, we don't need you to feel vulnerable right now. I mean,
you know. Right, exactly. So, you know, there are spaces in which that's not necessarily, let's say, the desirable, quote unquote, that's in very strict quotation marks, thing. But the arts give you permit, yeah. Or, you know, they give people permission to do that. And that's so important. And it really opens the floor for discussion with, if you're going to a performance, you might be in an auditorium that seats 4,000 people, and you're guaranteed to have all people with all kinds of different viewpoints and backgrounds. The likelihood of that being the case is very strong if you're attending a performance of any given kind. And yet all of these very different people are experiencing the same thing together, and that same sense of empathy. And that is such a powerful thing and such an important function of art in society.
Yeah. Hey, I'm going to do something a little bit out of, got a couple questions for you, Kinara. But I wanted, because the song was so special to me and how I ended up connecting to you and for the listeners, I just encountered Kinara a version of a song called Dodie Lee, which I've been working on a video project, and unfamiliar with the song. And it was so beautiful, and it made me it just moved me in, you know, to tears. It's just beautiful. Now, what is this? A traditional Jewish song, Dodie Lee, a love song. I wanted to play it, but another setup here. What is Dodie Lee?
Absolutely. And by the way, I'll actually kind of set up a couple of things. First of all, that this song is called Dodie Lee. So the text is taken from the Old Testament, from the Song of Songs. And, you know, the text is saying, you know, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. And this text is especially a poetic. And this arrangement of it is by a composer named Menachem Wiesenberg, and he composed arrangements of Israeli songs for a really great Israeli singer who passed away about a couple of years ago. Her name is Mira Zakai, and not only was she one of the greatest singers here in Israel, but she sung with some of the greatest conductors in the world, like Sir Georg Scholte, and really phenomenal career. And she was also one of my mentors. And so I'm singing one of those arrangements that was originally composed for her, and did it with her blessing.
Wow.
So I know. And so there's one thing. And then I know. And then the other thing is that this is a song, along with other Israeli songs, that I really love to program when I give recitals. And in recitals, as opposed to opera, you can program all kinds of different songs and kind of arrange them as a menu of sorts, you know, for your audience. And that is an environment in which an artist is able to express a lot more individuality. Because if you're performing in a full-length opera like, you know, La Traviata, La Bohème, Dialogues of the Carmelites, you're singing the pieces from that opera, you know, the arias from, you know, La Traviata. Or like if you were performing in musical theater, you're not going to be singing, you know, Phantom of the Opera. You know, you're singing only the pieces of My Fair Lady. So so with the art song recital, as opposed to an opera production, you can put together pieces that run just about the full gamut. So an artist has a lot more individuality in this respect, in this particular medium. And so in these, I always love to program a few Israeli songs. And oftentimes the audience falls in love with them, even without knowing a single word in Hebrew. Because again, the beauty of the music, the beauty of an unamplified human voice singing them is really something special. So Dodie Lee has been a very good friend to me in recitals.
Yeah, there's and thank you for going into it. Just a reminder, how it sounds, right? Without the language. I mean, I find you're in such an interesting position as far as the level of the language acquisition that you gain in order to be able to sing and sound like somebody who's from there, at the same time where you're communicating and saying, well, I know nobody's saying, knowing exactly the what I'm saying a lot of time as it's going on. It's a very curious way for you to have to communicate in that realm.
Oh, that said, though, you often do have native speakers of those operas in the audience, so watch out.
Well,
I mean, first of all, there's the quality component in that you do want to deliver these great works, you know, to the best of to the best that they can possibly be, you know. So if you're performing something like Shakespeare's, Hamlet, you don't you want to make sure that the English, you know, the Shakespearean English is as crisp and beautiful as possible to convey the play in all of its power. And so in that respect, opera is no different. You want to convey, you know, Italian opera in all of its power, French opera, or, you know, songs that are in Hebrew, you know, Israeli songs. So, or, you know, Czech in the case of Rusalka, you know, you really want to deliver that to the best of your ability. And so in this respect, it's really no difference than a Shakespearean actor, or I think of, let's say, Dame Judi Dench, you know, performing a Shakespeare play. So we're kind of, I guess, Shakespearean actors of opera.
That's where we got to. Okay, so we're going to cut to the track right now, Dodi Lee with Kinneret Ely. And after that, Kinneret, I'm going to ask you why there is something rather than nothing. So let's listen to the song first, though. I'm left in the similar circumstance of the last song we played, the last performance, very beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Very beautiful song. There's something I want to tell you that I picked out and that I connected for myself one time when I was lucky enough to see Itzhak Perlman in Portland for the Oregon Symphony. In his violin, in this song, somewhere is longing. It's just, there's longing in there. And I don't know how to describe it any other way, but I can just always hear it. I can hear it in there. It's somewhere in there. So it's
exactly
beautiful. That's the only word I got right now. It's beautiful.
Oh. Thank you so much. And I'm also joining in the Itzhak Perlman love. I mean, he's just, there are no words. He's so incredible.
He picked up the violin. So here's the thing. I started going to the Oregon Symphony because it was actually affordable through discounts a few years back. And of course, last year was last year, a pandemic. But when Itzhak came out, he had the violin and he had it and it was set up and he's slow getting around because of his ability to move right now. And he played the instrument and what he was doing. and the world was created in an instant. There was a complete other world, a complete other like change in place in time and geography. And then I knew, I'm like, that's okay. That's Perlman. Like, that's
Perlman. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's him harnessing those things that you can't simply express in words or in your day to day life. I mean, that's his superpower, you know? Yeah.
All right. All right. The big question. I'm really interested in your thoughts. Why is there something rather than nothing?
Because I think that something can also be can always be created out of something that doesn't look like it's much or unassuming looking. And a really incredible art exhibit that I saw to that point was about 5 years ago, if I remember the exact timing correctly. This was at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And it was of Matisse's cutouts. And so there were pieces of colored paper, you know, which were really sort of the leftover scraps, you know, that an artist would have in their studio. And Matisse arranged them in the most beautiful ways and just created wonder. I mean, wonder to be displayed at, you know, MoMA and other galleries all over the world. And it was made out of things that many people would have dismissed as scraps that a five-year-old would have, you know, cutting things out of construction paper. Yeah. And that's not to say Matisse used construction paper, but it is to say he used very unassuming materials and he used them to create wonders.
Right.
And actually artists, a lot of the time, use resources that on the surface wouldn't necessarily look like they're much. Let's say a rehearsal studio, which looking from the outside, it's not the most remarkable space. It could be a black box, you know, theater. It's quite simply a more or less empty room, a blank canvas. And yet wonders are able to be created in there. You know, these artistic wonders are able to be created in there. And that's true of rehearsal rooms. It's true of art studios. So in that sense, art is really wonderful in the sense that you can create something out of, I won't say nothing, I will say almost nothing. Because you always need a little bit of something. But for the most part, it's the creativity of people that helps make these into the most incredible somethings.
Yeah. Yeah, some things. That's
plural.
Well, and the thing is too with vocabulary and like in philosophy, a lot of time it comes to like things, right? Like, I mean, we can elevate our vocabulary. It's like, is this a thing? Is this a different thing than that thing? You know, and then you start laughing, and then like, okay, it's kind of all, you know. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for that. One of the things I want to do. And again, as you know, I feel particularly blessed by having you on this show. But one of the things that I like to do is connect you to the listeners in kind of like your art and what you do and how that happens. So where do folks go as they want to learn more about Kinneret Ely? Where do they go?
Yeah, so you can go to my website, kinneretely.com, and there you'll find my social media handles as well. So you'll find my Instagram and my YouTube, my Facebook, my Twitter. I use all of it. I love social media. So please connect with me there. I would love to see you. So yeah, kinneretely.com.
And I'm going to have you spell it just to...
Oh, of course. Yes. Excuse me. So that is KINNERETELY.
All right. That's so wonderful. I want folks to be able to hear your stuff, like the happenstance that I encountered you and able to talk to you. It's been a great pleasure. I've loved hearing your answers to these questions. And I mentioned to a lot of guests, I like my own personal thought to be propelled. Like, you know, so there's always a self-serving part of this show, just in the sense that I want to learn more and I want to be able to understand, you know, the tremendous art that I've encountered from the artists themselves. So, thank you so much for spending time with us. It's been a real great pleasure. I don't know what else to say. Well,
Oh, the feeling is mutual. Thank you so much again for having me. This has been wonderful and getting to talk about art. We don't typically get to speak about art quite at this level. And certainly not for an extended time like this. So this has been wonderful and such a blessing. Thanks so much again for having me.
I'm gonna keep doing it, and I'm sure we're gonna talk again. Thank you so much.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
This is Something Rather Than Nothing.